happened, and it seems likely now that she was not mistreated at an Iraqi hospital. Her heroic rescuers did not fight their way up the hospital halls. Indeed, the hospital staff may have been eager to hand her over. Lynch was in fact given special medical care by the Iraqi hospital staff for her wounds, none of which was battle-related. An Iraqi nurse sang her to sleep at night, and she was given extra juice and cookies. The hospital staff had already tried to turn her over to U.S. authorities and were in fact waiting for them to arrive. Iraqi forces had already vacated the area. While Lynch recovered in a U.S. hospital, television networks were tripping over themselves to get her exclusive story. CBS even offered her a package deal with book, concert, and TV movie prospects through CBS News, CBS Entertainment, MTV, and Simon & Schuster, all under the corporate umbrella of the huge Viacom Corporation. No matter where the Jessica Lynch tale ends up being told, it's sure to be more Survivor than The Real World. I feel sorry for her, a young woman who volunteered to risk her life to defend the United States, and she ends up being used like this, sandwiched in a mess hall full of Whoppers. Number 10. Triple Whopper Biggie Size. We didn't lie, and we're not lying now to cover up the lies we told you before. After a few in the media started to do their job and expose the lies of the Bush administration, after Bush struggled to find someone, anyone, to blame all the lying on, and after a majority of the American public said that they believed they were not told the whole truth about Iraq, Bush and company figured they had better come forward and put an end to this crisis once and for all. So this is what they did. They biggie-sized the Whoppers. This strategy is called the pile-on effect. If you are caught in a lie, just keep denying it and keep lying no matter what. Richard Pryor outlined this approach in his 1982 stand-up routine, Live on the Sunset Strip. Pryor suggested that when a man is caught by his wife in bed with another woman, he should deny everything, even though his wife is standing right there witnessing him naked and in bed with the other woman. Just deny that you were in the middle of having sex, said Pryor. Deny that there is even a woman in your bed. Now are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? One of the first Whoppers about the Whopper Squared, came last February when Colin Powell proclaimed, "My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence." Just days earlier, Powell apparently was not so sure. During a gathering of CIA officials reviewing the evidence against Saddam Hussein, Powell tossed the papers in the air and declared, "I'm not reading this. This is bullshit." And he had good reason to distrust the intelligence. A large chunk of Powell's background information had been lifted directly from sources easily located on the internet, including a graduate student's paper based on 12-year-old documents. Some sections had been outright plagiarized, to the extent that typos hadn't even been fixed, but Powell called all these Whoppers solid. Then White House spokesman Ari Fleischer gave it his spin. The president's statement was based on the predicate of the yellow cake, uranium, from Niger. So, given the fact that the report on the yellow cake did not turn out to be accurate, that is reflective of the president's broader statement. Huh? We'll leave the explaining to the Whopper Master himself, George W. Bush. I think the intelligence I get is darn good intelligence, and the speeches I have given were backed by good intelligence. I am absolutely convinced today, like I was convinced when I gave the speeches, that Saddam Hussein developed a program of weapons of mass destruction. Added Ari Fleischer, the president has moved on, and I think, frankly, much of the country has moved on as well. Maybe in his country, but not in mine. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld quickly dished up some more Whoppers on Meet the Press. It turns out that it's technically correct what the president said, but in the aggregate, do we believe that they had chemical and biological weapons and a nuclear program in progress? The answer is yes, I believe that. Rumsfeld added, And right before it, I said, as the president said, and right after it, I said, as the president said. I was simply repeating what the president had said. Are you following this? Before your head spins completely off your neck, let's turn to Condoleezza Rice to clear it all up for us. She had this to say to CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Wolf, let me just start by saying it is 16 words, and it has become an enormously overblown issue. Now, I think now that we're in Iraq, and we are interviewing scientists, and we are looking at the documents, and we are finding, for instance, that he had somebody bury centrifuge parts in their yard. That whopper had spoiled so badly that it got Blitzer's attention, and Rice was forced to admit that her evidence was 12 years old. Before the first Gulf War, well, in 1991. Undeterred, Rice also appeared that day on Face the Nation, where she insisted that the President's State of the Union said something that was accurate. We use a lot of data points. We give them to writers. They go to speeches. And then we rely on a clearance process. And if you notice, the President's statement says, in Africa. It's not specific. It says he sought. It didn't say he received or he acquired. It's that he sought. And it cites the British document. It just doesn't stop. Whoppers on top of whoppers. So many whoppers, it could make a person sick. So many whoppers that even a witness to world-class lying, former Nixon aide John Dean, was moved to comment, "It's important to recall that when Richard Nixon resigned, he was about to be impeached by the House of Representatives for misusing the CIA and FBI. Why are there no consequences for telling all these whoppers? Why is George W. Bush still occupying our White House? Where are the articles of impeachment? How many more whoppers will it take before Congress is full?" Chapter 3. Oil's Well That Ends Well. Last night I had a dream. Actually, I had a number of dreams. One had something to do with smearing tofutti on a camel. Another involved me pushing around golfing great Fred Couples as he sat in my shopping cart while he recited sections of the Bhagavad Gita inside a Target store in Modesto, California. I know, I need help. It was one of those nights when you have been out partying too hard, and it's like once your head hits the pillow, some sort of high-speed mega-channel DirecTV comes on in your subconscious, and you can't find the remote to turn it off. I had been out celebrating the killings of Uday and Qusay Hussein with friends and loved ones. You can never discount the importance of getting together with those close to you when your government is able to corner and gun down people we don't like. But one too many shots of tequila, with the whole bar chanting, "Uday, Uday, Uday," as I chugged them down, was a bit too much, even for me. I hadn't partied this hard since the state of Texas executed that retard guy. Anyway, back to my main dream. It was so real, it felt like something right out of Scrooge. Suddenly, I was in the future. It was the year 2054, and it was the occasion of my 100th birthday. Either I had joined a health food co-op some years earlier, or, for some reason, the world ran out of Ben & Jerry's because I was looking pretty good for 100. In this dream, I received a surprise visit from my great-granddaughter, Ann Coulter Moore. I have no idea how she got that name, and I was too frightened to ask. She told me she was doing an oral history project for her 6th grade class at school, and she wanted to ask me a few questions. But there were no lights, she had no computer, and the water she was drinking was not in a bottle. Here is how the conversation went, as best as I can recall. Ann Coulter Moore. "Hi, Great-Grandpa. I brought you a candle. For some reason, we got an extra one with our monthly ration. I figured there might not be enough light for the interview." Michael Moore. "Thank you, Annie. Now, if there is any way you could leave me that pencil you're using when you're done, I could burn it to keep me warm." A. "Sorry, Great-Grandpa, but if I give it to you, then I will have nothing to write with for the rest of the year. Back in your day, didn't you have other things to use when you wrote something?" M. Yes, we had pens and computers, and we had little machines you could speak into, and out would come the writing. A. What happened to those? M. Well, dear, it takes plastic to make them. A. Oh, yes, plastic. Did everyone love plastic back then? M. It was a magical substance, but it was made from oil. A. I see. And ever since the oil dried up, we've had to use these pencils. M. That's right. Boy, we all miss the oil, don't we? A. When you were young, were people really so stupid to think that there was enough oil to last forever, or did they just not care about us? M. Of course we cared. But in my day, our leaders swore on a stack of Bibles there was plenty of oil, and, of course, we wanted to believe them because we were having so much fun. A. So, when you started to run out of oil and you knew the end was near, what did you do? M. We tried to keep things under control by dominating those parts of the world where most of the remaining oil and natural gas was located. Many wars were fought. For the early wars, in Kuwait and Iraq, our leaders had to come up with excuses like, this bad guy had bad weapons, or these good people needed to be liberated. We like that word, liberated. But the fighting was never really for any of those reasons. It was always about the oil. We just couldn't speak plainly in those days. The early wars didn't cost us a lot of lives, so it seemed everything would remain normal. But those wars only gave us a few more years of oil. A. I heard that when you were born there was so much oil that you switched to making everything out of it, and that most of these things would be used once and thrown away. A couple of years ago, Mom and Dad got scavenger permits for the dump. Mom said they'd struck it rich. They found a bunch of plastic bags that hadn't decomposed one bit, and inside them were lots of things made of plastic. You guys sure were smart to preserve all that stuff so neatly in those bags. M. Well, thank you, but it was just a lucky accident. You're right that we made everything from oil by turning it into plastic. Furniture upholstery, grocery bags, toys, bottles, clothes, medicines, even baby diapers were made from oil. The list of what was made with oil and byproducts of oil was endless. Aspirin, cameras, golf balls, car batteries, carpet, fertilizers, eyeglasses, shampoo, glue, computers, cosmetics, detergents, telephones, food preservatives, footballs, insecticides, luggage, nail polish, toilet seats, pantyhose, toothpaste, pillows, soft contact lenses, tires, pins, CDs, sneakers, you name it, and it came in some way from oil. Man, we were hooked on the stuff. We would take a drink from a plastic bottle and throw it away. We might burn a gallon of oil to drive to a store for a gallon of milk, which came in a plastic bottle, too. Every Christmas, your grandmother would get presents mostly made of plastic under a plastic Christmas tree, but made to look real. And yes, it's true we even wrapped our garbage in plastic and tossed it out. A. Where did people come up with the idea for burning oil? Why would you burn something you have only a little bit of? Did people burn diamonds back then too? M. No, people didn't burn diamonds. Diamonds were considered precious. Oil was considered precious too, but no one cared. We just turned it into gasoline, lit a spark plug, and burned the damn stuff any chance we could. A. What was it like when you couldn't breathe because of the dirty air caused by burning what you called gasoline? Didn't that make you realize that anything that came from oil wasn't supposed to be burned? Maybe that smell was nature's way of trying to tell you, don't burn me. M. Ooh, that smell. It was nature's way of telling you something's wrong. What were we thinking? What were we singing? A. Huh? M. Never mind. A. But it was poisoning you, and you didn't have breathing stations like we do now, so what did you do? M. People would just have to suck it up and breathe it in. This caused millions of people to suffer and die. No one wanted to say it was air pollution from burning fossil fuels that was making it hard to breathe, so doctors said we had asthma or allergies. While you think of a ride in an automobile as something you do at a museum, in those days most people were commuting 20, 30, even 40 miles to work, and they hated the hours they spent trapped in their cars. It put them in really bad moods. A. So you burned up all the precious oil while hating yourselves? Weird. M. Hey, I didn't say we hated ourselves. We hated the commute, but lots of people thought it was worth it because they didn't want to live in cities that had lots of different people living in them. A. What I don't get is if you were having all this fun, driving around and stuff, using up all our oil, why didn't you plan to switch over to another fuel before you ran out so you could keep having fun? M. The American people were the kind of people who would get stuck on doing things one way and never want to change. A. What's American? M. Let's not get into that. A. My sixth grade teacher told us one of your leaders believed hydrogen fuel cells would replace gasoline cars, but they didn't. That was crazy. Today every kid knows that hydrogen is hard to get. Sure, it's an H2O, but it takes a lot of energy to break off the hydrogen, and a lot of energy was what you didn't have. Duh. M. You're right, Anne. We were all hepped up on so much Prozac and cable television that we always believed what our leaders told us. We even believed them when they said that hydrogen was the second coming, limitless, pollution-free energy that will soon replace oil. We spent so much money on our military to make sure we had access to oil that our schools were falling apart, making everyone grow up dumb and dumber. And therefore, no one realized that hydrogen was not even a fuel at all. It got so bad, most college graduates didn't even know what H2O stood for. Soon things really got bad. We ran low on oil, and there wasn't any hydrogen to run our cars, so people got really mad, but it was too late. That's when the die-off began. A. I know, the food ran out. M. At the time, it seemed like a good idea to use oil to grow food. It does seem funny now that no one seemed to realize that the massive food production needed to keep so many people alive could not be sustained for very long. That was probably our worst mistake of all. The artificial fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides, not to mention all the tractors and agricultural equipment, depended on fossil fuels. When oil production peaked, the price of food went up in lockstep with the price of fossil fuels. The world's poor starved to death first. But as soon as people realized what was happening, stores and warehouses were attacked, and being rich was little guarantee of having enough food to eat. To make matters worse, when the die-off began, people could not afford to get to work, to heat their homes, to buy electricity. There were some experts who predicted world oil production would peak around 2015, and they were laughed at. But they were right. Fuel prices began escalating ever more sharply, but it was too late to plan for a smooth transformation to a different way to obtain energy. The catastrophe was upon us. A. Great Grandpa, why are you pushing a golfer around in a shopping cart? M. Oh, sorry, that's from my other dream. Fred, get the blinkety-blank out of here. A. I have a theory about what happened. I heard that your generation loved the sun and laid out in it all the time, just sleeping. I think that's why you used up all the cheap oil, so you could heat up the earth, get rid of winter, and everyone could get really cool tans and look cool. M. No, actually, we were scared to death of the sun. Most of us worked in buildings with windows sealed tight, with machines to filter and clean our air and water. When we did venture outside, we would slather ourselves in sunblock and put on dark sunglasses and hats to shield our heads. But as much as we hated the sun, we hated the cold even more. Everyone was moving to the hot states where it rarely snowed, and then spent their days in air-conditioned homes and offices and rode around in air-conditioned automobiles. Of course, this used even more gasoline, and that made the world even hotter, which made people turn up the air conditioning even more. A. Why did they invent nuclear bombs if they wanted to kill everyone at once when they already had oil-based bombs? When they turned the nuclear bombs into nuclear power plants, didn't they know one might blow up and burn everyone? M. 100 years ago, we were told nuclear fission would produce electricity too cheap to meter. Never happened. The second President Bush, or was it the third President Bush? Well, definitely not the fourth President Bush. One of those damn Bushes stepped up nuclear plant production, But after a disgruntled nuke plant worker filled up his pickup with fertilizer and detergent and smashed it into his place of employment, destroying a small town nearby, the program was quickly dropped. A. Dad says in your day there were over 6 billion people in the world. Sometimes I get scared, but I try not to think about the time when so many people died of starvation and disease all over the world. In school, I heard there are now about 500 million people in the world. It sounds like a lot to me, but I get a little worried sometimes that the die-off might still be going on. What do you think? M. Don't worry. The die-off is over. You are safe now. Just keep digging up all that plastic, and you'll be okay. A. Great-grandpa, how did you survive? M. Your great-grandma and I were traveling overseas when the great die-off began. We were able to survive because, somewhere in the big oil region, we found a cave with lots of food and cell phones and a FedEx box. I never would have believed someone could survive in a cave that long and not be detected, but we did, just like whoever used the cave before us. The only strange thing is, there was a dialysis machine in there. I kept thinking, nah, this couldn't be. A. Dad said he hoped you and great-grandma would move back in with us so we could all stay warmer. Even though I am mad at you for using up all the oil and not even saving a gallon for us, maybe it would be nicer to have family here when we snuggle under the family quilt when the temperature drops below zero and we can't get the neighbors to come over. Once it was so cold, we had to get a couple of animals to sleep with us, and even though it was warmer, the stink was so bad I couldn't go to sleep. Mom said that you even sometimes heated the outdoors just so you could stand around without a jacket and sip drinks. Can you and great-grandma come stay with us? M. Why, yes, I would love to, but I'm afraid at our age, we stink pretty bad, too. A. Mom said you were once famous for a few minutes for yelling about something during one of the oil wars. Now all we have is this old photo of you with your mouth open and pointing at something. And you're using two fingers. What were you angry about? Was it the oil? M. Well, great-grandma won't let me discuss this as long as she is alive. She got all dressed up that night and everything, and she was so beautiful and... Here, hand over that picture, little girl. I'm starting to hear boos in my head. A. Sure, here it is. Thanks, great-grandpa. Any last words? Your candle is almost gone. M. Yes, you know, as I look back on it now, the 10 years between 2005 and 2015 were the most critical time on this planet for our species. Many of us tried to warn everyone else of the danger of running out of oil, but few listened. There were good people, people who cared about each other, our children, and the planet. We struggled, but not hard enough. The forces of selfish greed fought harder. They seemed bent on extinction. And almost succeeded. I'm sorry. We're sorry. Perhaps you can do better. It was right around then, when I was getting all preachy and schmaltzy, that I woke out of my dream in a cold sweat, mumbling something about an overdue dry cleaning bill in Toledo. I sat straight up in bed and then realized it was only a dream, that nothing as ridiculous as all that could ever happen. And so I laid back down and got all nice and cozy underneath the electric blanket and fell back asleep with sweet dreams of Tofutti dancing in my head. Chapter 4. The United States of Boo. There is no terrorist threat. You need to calm down, relax, listen very carefully, and repeat after me. There is no terrorist threat. There is no terrorist threat. There is no terrorist threat. Feel better? Not really, huh? I know, it's hard. Amazing how it didn't take long to pound that belief so deep into our psyche that the country, the world, is teeming with terrorists. Madmen are running amok on their evil mission to destroy every living American infidel. Of course, it didn't help for us to watch the mass murder of 3,000 people obliterated before our very eyes. That would tend to convince even the most cynical among us that there are people out there who don't like us and would like to see fewer of us in the world. Why do they hate us? Our leader knew why, just days after September 11 when he addressed the nation. They want us to stop flying, and they want us to stop buying. But this great nation will not be intimidated by the evildoers. Now, when I say that there is no terrorist threat, I am not saying that there are no terrorists, or that there are no terrorist incidents, or that there won't be other terrorist incidents in the future. There are terrorists, they have committed evil acts, and tragically, they will commit acts of terror in the not-too-distant future. Of that, I am sure. But just because there are a few terrorists does not mean we are all in some exaggerated state of danger. Yet when they speak of terrorists, they speak of them as if they are in the millions, and that they're everywhere, and that they're never going away. Cheney has called this a new normalcy, a condition that will become permanent in American life. They only hope. They call it a war on terror. How exactly do you conduct a war on a noun? Wars are fought against countries, religions, and peoples. They are not fought against nouns or problems. And any time it has been attempted, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, it fails. Our leaders would have us believe this is a guerrilla war, fought by thousands of foreign terrorist soldiers hidden on our soil. But that is not what is taking place, and it is time to do a reality check. Americans are rarely targets of international terrorism, and almost never on U.S. soil. In the year 2000, your chance as an American of being killed in a terrorist attack in the United States was exactly zero. In 2002, your chance of dying in a terrorist incident was, again, zero. And in 2003, as of this writing, the total number of people to die in the United States from acts of terror? Zero. Even in the tragic year of 2001, your chance as an American of dying in an act of terrorism in this country was 1 in 100,000. In 2001, you had a greater chance of dying from the flu or pneumonia, 1 in 4,500, from taking your own life, 1 in 9,200, being a homicide victim, 1 in 14,000, or riding in a car, 1 in 6,500. But no one freaked out over the possibility of being killed every time you drove in your dangerous car to buy a heart disease-inducing donut from a coughing teenager. The suicide rate alone means that you were a greater danger to yourself than any terrorist. All these causes of death were far greater than the terrorism, but there were no laws passed, no countries bombed, no emergency expenditures of billions of dollars per month, no National Guard units dispatched, no orange alerts, and no nonstop tickers scrolling details across the bottom of CNN to send us in a panic over them. There was no response from the public but indifference and denial, or at best, an acceptance that these tragedies were just part of life. But when multiple deaths happened at the same time, with such viciousness and on live TV, no rationalization with statistics like those can undo the visceral response of witnessing actual horror as we did on September 11. We have come to believe that we are in harm's way, that any of us anywhere in this vast country could die at any time. Never mind that the chances of that happening are virtually nil. A mass psychosis has gripped the country. I'm part of it. You're part of it. Even high-ranking generals who now weep openly are part of it. That's right. I'm caught up in it, too. I live part of the year in New York City, and every day I'm there, I wonder if today is the day when the other shoe will drop. I hear loud bangs outside my window, and I flinch. I see planes flying too low, and I watch them with a suspicious eye. I check out everyone sitting near me when I fly, and I always carry a weapon with me on the plane. That's right, I carry a weapon, a legal weapon. I have a baseball in my carry-on bag. It was a gift from Rudy Giuliani when we filmed TV Nation in New York. It's signed by all the 1994 New York Yankees. I figure I could get off a pretty good 50-mile-an-hour fastball if some motherfucker was trying to break down the cockpit door. The baseball, when stuffed inside a long sock, works well, too. You give it a good swing, and wham, a knockout wallop to the head. Also, shoelaces, when wrapped between my hands, would make a nice strangling device once I get them around the bastard's neck. Whatever it takes, by any means necessary, I ain't going down without a fight. See, I'm messed up too. I guess knowing and having worked with someone who died on one of those planes will do that to you. How did I get to this place? Little old pacifist me. Hell, I'm scared, just like everyone else. Fear, the rational kind, is a critical part of our ability to survive. Sensing real danger and acting appropriately is an instinct that has served our species well throughout the millennia. But irrational fear is a killer. It throws off our survival compass. It makes us reach for a gun when we hear a noise in the middle of the night, and you end up shooting your wife who was just on her way to the bathroom. It makes us not want to live near someone of another race, and it allows us to willingly give up the civil liberties we have enjoyed for more than 200 years, simply because our leader tells us there is a terrorist threat. Fear is so basic and yet so easy to manipulate that it has become both our best friend and our worst enemy. When it is used as a weapon against us, it has the ability to destroy much of what we have come to love about life in the United States of America. According to the Bush administration and the stories they have planted in the media, the terrorists are everywhere. Each day seems to bring a new warning, a new alert, a new threat. Watch out for model airplanes packed with explosives. The FBI law enforcement bulletin reported that they faced off a terrorist threat from an unconventional weapon in the form of sarin gas. After the tiny canister was seized from a model airplane builder and flown to a special army base by hazardous materials support personnel in a special military aircraft, the modeling enthusiast admitted he labeled an empty canister sarin gas as a joke. Nonetheless, the government issued an alert to be on the lookout for model airplanes that could fly explosives into a building, and cable news channels presented experts in mid-July 2003 to warn us of the grave danger. People might be lurking near train tracks, preparing to derail trains. The FBI issued a warning to law enforcement agencies throughout the U.S. about a possible attack against transportation systems, particularly railways, in October 2002. Intelligence officials said they had seen captured Al-Qaeda photos of train engines and railroad crossings. Geez, I hope they haven't seen my Lionel setup in the basement. Beware of shoe bombs. The FBI says the explosive the shoe bomber used, TATP, is presently undetectable in regular airport scanners. And explosives experts say it can be made in a basic lab by anyone with a college degree in chemistry. The last time I saw someone light their shoes on fire was at an ELO concert in 1978 at the IMA Auditorium in Flint. Some guy who had been drinking too much puked on his shoes, and then someone next to him lit a match and dropped it, and the guy's alcohol-laced puke ignited his Converse into a really cool blaze. Look for suspicious people lingering near gas stations. Now there's something we never see, but an alert Oklahoma pump attendant called authorities when a group pulled in with two vans and an equipment truck. Within minutes, police and FBI had surrounded, with guns drawn, the rock band Godspeed You, Black Emperor. Released after hours of questioning, singer Ephraim Menick told Seattle Weekly, "We're just lucky we're nice white kids from Canada." Al-Qaeda may be setting wildfires in the western U.S. The Arizona Republic reported that an FBI memo to law enforcement agencies alerted them that Al-Qaeda had developed a plan to set midsummer forest fires in Colorado, Montana, Utah, and Wyoming, so that once it was realized that the fires were terrorist acts, U.S. citizens would put pressure on the U.S. government to change its policies. Terrorists are trading in sham consumer goods, like fake Sony stereo equipment, fake Nikes, and Calvin Klein jeans. Not long ago, an Al-Qaeda supporter sent a shipment of counterfeit perfume, shampoo, and cologne from Dubai to Dublin. It's scary to think of all the damage that counterfeit perfume can do. Congress has extended this argument of counterfeit goods to counterfeit drugs. How convenient to prevent access to cheap Canadian drugs by saying there's the possibility that terrorists will ship tainted drugs to us. Especially keep an eye out for undercover Al-Qaeda agents with portable blowtorches attempting to cut through the 21,736 wires holding up the Brooklyn Bridge. The FBI nabbed a truck driver who had been casing the bridge and counting the wires. Best estimate is that you could cut through the wires in about a week, so be on alert. Report any powdery substance you come across. After receiving a suspicious powdery substance in the mail, a New Orleans woman called the authorities, and firefighters, postal officials, police officers, and FBI agents quickly arrived to investigate. It turned out to be a free sample of laundry detergent. But that doesn't mean there aren't terrorists out there, even if the authorities suspect that the anthrax scare of 2001 was an inside job by someone who had access to the substance in the U.S. government or government-approved programs. Boy, those terrorists sure are busy. Explosive model airplanes, satin gas, forest fires, lions, tigers, bears, the boogeyman is coming to get me. Run for your lives! The only thing more amazing than this phony game of boo is our ability to fall for it. What happened to our basic common sense? You know, that reflex in your brain that used to make you scream bullshit when confronted with such obvious nonsense? This is what happens when your fear radar is out of whack. You're so discombobulated you can't distinguish any longer between the real and unreal. Why has our government gone to such absurd lengths to convince us our lives are in danger? The answer is nothing short of their feverish desire to rule the world, first by controlling us, and then, in turn, getting us to support their efforts to dominate the rest of the planet. Sounds crazy, huh? It reads more like a movie script, doesn't it? But Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Wall Street, Fortune 500 see this post-September 11 America in fear as their moment. A moment handed to them by fate, via the terrorists, to seize the reins and ram the USA down the throats of any people in the world who dare question who is number one. Who is number one? I said, who is number one? That's right, say it loud. Say it for George and Dick and Johnny and Condi. We are number one. USA! 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 They know that real Americans are not into dominating anyone, so they have to sell it to us in fancy packaging. And that package is fear. In order to properly scare us, they need a big bad enemy. Once the Soviet Union disappeared, Bush Sr. couldn't figure it out. Before he knew it, Clinton had given him the boot. The right wing was out in the cold, but they had 8 long years to plot their return. To their rescue came a high-powered political think tank, the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, which argued that America should have but one goal, an unchallengeable, military-imposed, U.S.-run world. They took their first step on January 26, 1998, in an open letter to President Clinton. PNAC neoconservatives Paul Wolfowitz and William Kristol, along with Donald Rumsfeld and Richard Perle, warned that the policy of containing Iraq was dangerously inadequate, and that the aim of U.S. foreign policy must be removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. When Bush Jr. seized power in 2000, he turned the Pentagon over to this radical right-wing nut group. After September 11, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, now Rumsfeld's Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the war crowd immediately pushed an attack on Iraq as one of the first actions in the new permanent war against terror. Their next act rushed through a $400 billion defense budget, including $70 billion for new weapons. Because of September 11, Wolfowitz and his right-wing hawk buddies had found the enemy they could sell to the public. Former Clinton CIA director James Woolsey joined in, declaring that World War IV had begun. The Cold War being World War III. By this thinking, the war on terror would be unilateral and without limits. It could last as long as the Cold War, 50 years, or longer, maybe forever. And if you don't believe me, maybe Donald Rumsfeld can convince you. It undoubtedly will prove to be a lot more like a Cold War than a hot war, Rummy said. If you think about it, in the Cold War it took 50 years, plus or minus. It did not involve major battles. It involved continuous pressure. It strikes me that that might be a more appropriate way to think about what we are up against here. Wow, a war without end? If you get the people to believe this, they'll let you do anything, just as long as it's in the name of protecting them. This is Bush's version of the old mafia protection racket. There's somebody out there who's gonna mess you up. Osama, he did it. Saddam, he did it. Those crazy Ayatollahs, they might do it. North Korea, they could do it. Hello, PLO. We'll protect you. Just give us all your money and all your rights. And keep your trap shut. For the next year, leading up to the 2004 election, all you are going to hear from Bush is how there is a war going on, a war on terror, a war to liberate and rebuild Iraq, a war against Iranian clerics, a war against North Korean nuclear madmen, a war against Colombian drug lords, a war against extremism, a war against communism in Cuba, a war against Hamas, a war against... And to maintain the endless war, they need endless fear, a fear that can only be extended indefinitely by taking away our basic civil rights. The right wing needs to keep this war, that war, going for as long as possible because it keeps people distracted. Everyone, except those who die in it, loves a good war, especially one you can win quickly. We good, them bad, them dead, we win. Cue the cameras. The victorious POTUS is landing on the air carrier. This is how Bush intends to run his entire re-election campaign. I won you a war. Then I won you another war. But there are more wars, and you need me to win them too. It'll be that old slogan, you shouldn't change horses in the middle of the stream. But this is no stream, folks. This will be a tidal wave that can swamp our democracy. Give these guys four more years, and do you think they will give up their megalomaniacal schemes peacefully to a duly elected Democrat or Green? How many of our freedoms and our children are we willing to sacrifice just so they can line their pockets with all the money that can be made from a terrified nation and a permanent war? You are not going to be killed by a terrorist. We have seriously lost our sense of perspective, and it is being used against us, not by the terrorists, but by leaders seeking to terrorize us. A great president once said that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. He encouraged and inspired a nation. Now we have nothing to fear but George W. Bush. It is my firm belief that Bush and his cronies, especially Attorney General